from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. An armed attack by right-wing militia members on unarmed local protesters who were operating a checkpoint in Slavyansk resulted in a number of dead on both sides. RT's Graham Phillips reports from Slavyansk.
So what happened here is that in the early hours of the morning, a convoy of four cars pulled up to this checkpoint some 6 kilometres outside the city of Slavyansk and immediately opened fire on this checkpoint, which was manned by anti-Kiev activists unarmed. We have reports of three of them being immediately killed. What they did was relay a message into the city, and members returned on the anti-Kiev side bearing heavy arms and returned fire on the attackers with, as we can see, these two cars behind me destroyed. We do have reports of two killed on the side of the attackers who many have connected, many have reported as being members of the Pravi sector, this of course being the far-right neo-Nazi organization responsible for a series of terrorist attacks around Ukraine. I've got bullets in my hand, and we have bullets littering the ground around here, with the death toll reported as being 5 at the moment, marking this as the sharpest escalation of violence here in the east of Ukraine.
We were here manning the checkpoint and saw four SUVs approaching with their headlights on full beam. One of our guys asked them to turn off their headlights, show their IDs and open the trunk. Instead, a rifle barrel came out of the window and shot him down. Immediately, people jumped out of the cars and opened fire on us. They started throwing stun grenades and yelling, "Get down!" Our guys scattered, running into the woods. Some of them tried to run back to the city, but there was a sniper cutting off their retreat. The first guy who came out of the wood was immediately shot by the sniper. So that was the second person they killed. There was another guy with him, and he just hit the ground and stayed down, unable to move. Very soon, reinforcements came from the city. There was gunfire from both sides. Then the attackers realized that they were outnumbered, jumped into two SUVs and drove away.
Russia blamed the acting authorities in Kiev Monday for the violence in eastern Ukraine, accusing them of trying to ignite a civil war in a region where pro-Russian militants have been defying the central government.
Russia is outraged by this provocation, which shows that the Kyiv authorities are not willing to subdue and disarm nationalists and extremists. Surprisingly, the tragedy happened after Russia, US, EU and Ukraine's representatives signed a joint statement urging the conflicting parties to refrain from violence and provocations. Russia insists that the Ukrainian authorities must meet their commitment to de-escalate the situation in southeastern Ukraine.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow will intervene if the bloodshed continues, even as Ukrainian officials accuse Russia of stirring it up. He said Russia was being put into an extremely complex position.
The most important thing now is to prevent any kind of violence. This is the first point of the Geneva Agreement. It's the first demand to all those confronting each other in Ukraine. But in this and other respects, the Geneva Agreement is not being implemented. And moreover, steps are being taken, above all by those who seize power in Kiev, to crudely violate the Geneva Agreement.
The Russian foreign minister added, quote, "Those who are deliberately pursuing a civil war in a possible attempt to start a big, serious, bloody conflict are pursuing a criminal policy. And we will not only condemn this policy, but will also stop it," closed quote. Lavrov's warning came as U.S. Vice President Joseph Biden arrived in Kiev Monday for a two-day visit to meet with acting government leaders, civil society groups, and U.S. diplomats. He was reportedly bringing unspecified economic assistance, as well as another set of warnings to Russia that future intervention in Ukraine's volatile east will incur new costs. It appears that the use of goon squads rather than the Ukrainian military in yesterday's attack by the acting government in Kiev was due to continuing doubts among many of the troops about the legitimacy of the coup regime. RT's Paula Slyer spoke with some of those who said only a few days ago didn't expect they would be ordered to use force against their own people.
The battle is brutal, and as this former miner turned commander shows me, it's far from over. Alexander tells me the army is divided. 40% of soldiers say they will not fight. At least that's what his younger brother says. He is serving in the Ukrainian army.
The army doesn't send him and others to Donetsk because they are from that city. They know that they will get rid of their commander and join us.
You're supposed to protect us.
We're not going to shoot. We weren't even planning on it.
But that's not how everyone feels.
If they tried to storm the base, which is a guarded territory, I would use arms. That's what I should do according to the law.
And this border guard we spoke to is also ready to open fire.
We have the right to use arms without approval from higher ranks, and we will act by law.
But whose law? Confusion ensued earlier this week when the army entered Kramatorsk in eastern Ukraine.
What order did you get?
We didn't have any orders. We just came here and that's it. We didn't expect we would come here.
Is General Krutov your chief command?
We don't know who he is.
How do your soldiers feel?
We're all tired. We do not know what's going on. But we will not shoot. No way.
In another incident, dozens of soldiers sent to Slavyansk, also eastern Ukraine, refused to follow orders. The situation is taxing on everyone.
This barracks in the Ukrainian countryside seems almost like an oasis. It's so peaceful and quiet here that you can almost forget about the unrest gripping the rest of the country. But we're warned not to speak a word of Ukrainian. Doing so here could put our lives in danger.
There is not one place in Ukraine today that is untouched by the fighting. Polislia RT, Donetsk.
Sarah Flanders is the director of the International Action Center in New York. She described the situation in Ukraine in this interview with Press TV.
Now, first of all, why do you think that the interim government in Kiev continues to blame Russia for the situation right now that we're seeing in the eastern and southern parts of Ukraine?
Well, first of all, this is a totally discredited government on the basis of a coup against the elected government. And it was organized by fascists with almost no backing among the population of Ukraine, and at the same time, strong U.S. backing and support. Within 2 days of the fascists seizing power, seizing the buildings in the Ukraine, Yatsenyuk is sitting in the White House, recognized by the U.S., taken to the U.N. Security Council, and so on. So this is a weak government, desperate, and the only thing they have to offer to the people of the Ukraine is horrendous austerity, cutbacks, price raises, because this is all about both the U.S. and the EU paying the loans, paying the interest on the loans. They have no interest in the people of the Ukraine, and now this discredited, weak government, based on a coup, is facing an uprising among its own population, especially in the east and south of the Ukraine.
Right. Now, looking at the rhetoric that's coming out, not just from within Kiev, but also from the U.S. in particular, where we're also seeing more calls being made to level more sanctions against Russia. Do you think then that this basically goes against the spirit of the Geneva deal that was reached just a few days ago to bring the situation in Ukraine under control?
Well, really, the U.S. is nonstop issuing ultimatums and really talking about imposing a new Cold War, a very dangerous situation. The Geneva Agreement really called for those who had illegally seized buildings and illegally had arms to give up their arms and leave the buildings that they had seized. Now, who did that? And that is first and foremost the fascist forces in Kiev, the right sector, and all of those forces. So if there's going to be a disarming, if there's going to be a handing over of buildings, it should first be the forces in Kiev who carried out the coup. And this is a position taken both by those resisting in the Ukraine who have seized, in response, seized government buildings and stopped tanks that were coming from the central government, coming from Kiev. And the very drivers of these armored personnel carriers ended up siding with the people and refusing to fire. So at this moment, the Ukraine doesn't really have a military they can rely on. They're more desperate for U.S. intervention, involvement, more desperate for NATO involvement, desperate for funding that has been cut off, and really are in a weak and unsustained position in the face of an uprising and in the face of their own bankrupt government.
The elected president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, called on Ukrainian troops and security forces to refuse to follow what he termed criminal orders from the acting authorities in Kiev. In a statement released to the media on Monday, he called for a series of regional referendums on the federalization of the country before presidential and parliamentary elections are held, which are currently set for late May. Otherwise, he said, the country risks civil war. He said the plebiscites should be held under the scrutiny of international observers. Meanwhile, it appears that what may be good for the goose in Ukraine may not be good for the gander in Syria. While the U.S.-backed authorities in Kiev, who came to power after a coup d'etat, rushed towards next month elections with themselves in control of the process, June elections in Syria, where the elected president and parliament remain in power, should not be allowed to go forward. So says a spokesperson for the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Derek Mbata reports.
The Syrian authorities are being urged by the United Nations not to hold presidential elections amidst the ongoing conflict and massive displacement of people. On Monday, the Syrian government said that the elections will be held on the 3rd of June. The country has been at civil war for 3 years. Over 100,000 people have been killed, and millions need humanitarian assistance both inside and outside the country. Stefan Dujarric is UN spokesperson.
The holding of elections in the current circumstances amid the ongoing conflict and massive displacement will damage the political process and hamper the prospects for political solution that the country so urgently needs. Such elections are incompatible with the letter and spirit of the Geneva communique. We will nonetheless continue to search and build upon any opening for a solution to the tragedy in Syria.
There are also reports that the Speaker of Parliament announced that the Constitutional Court will start accepting nominations for president on Tuesday. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
U.S.-backed insurgents continue to battle the Syrian government, with a pair of mortar shells almost hitting the parliament building in central Damascus Monday, killing 5 people. The mortar struck some 100 meters from parliament in the Salahiyah area of the Syrian capital early Monday morning. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the attack. The insurgents routinely fire mortar shells into government-controlled areas of Damascus. For more on the fighting in Syria, we have this report from Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar.
On April 17th, Syria pressed forward with efforts to end an insurgency led by Islamist forces and armed by the West after talks between the government and opposition broke down. The civil war has continued on, with many international observers saying Syria has gained the upper hand. Up now in Liberation Radio is Mazda Majidi. He puts the conflict in context.
We have Bashar Assad declaring turning points and even stating that the civil war will be decided within a year. We even have Hassan Nasrallah, who is the leader of Hezbollah, who has been engaged in the fighting supporting the Syrian government. Nasrallah said that, you know, Assad is no longer in danger of falling. His state is no longer in danger of being overthrown. And, you know, while in any war and civil war, different leaders make claims and make, you know, claims of victories and claims of turning points and so forth. This is clearly a case where the victories of the Syrian state, of the Syrian Arab army, have really piled up, and defeats on the part of the rebels, really different groupings of the rebels, have also piled up. So, you know, while we can't tell for certainty what is going to happen in the future, particularly in view of what the possibilities are with what the U.S. can do and what Saudi Arabia and Qatar and others may do, there's no question that there has been a major turn in favor of Bashar Assad's government in Syria. Things are not where they used to be. As just one example, if you think of the conference that was held in Geneva in late spring of 2012. At the time, the main issue that the U.S. and its European junior partners were concerned with was how to replace the state in Damascus and how to come up with the right combination of forces that would serve the interest of, really serve the interest of the U.S. and its European allies. The next year, when so-called Geneva II happened, the U.S. and its allies tried to continue going on the basis of the same assumptions. And in fact, they kept saying that, well, you know, whoever is attending Geneva II must accept the kind of the agreements that were made in Geneva I. But it was already a conference, a convention that was being held in a different environment where the balance of the forces on the ground had changed in Assad's favor. So now that's even since that time till now, we see more and more of that happening. Victories of the rebel forces are few and far in between. The Syrian military seems to be making steady gains. In other words, whatever initiatives that the Syrian army has taken in recent months, it has been successful.
Turkey, Jordan, Israel, and many of Syria's neighbors have been in the news in recent months. What is the status of those countries in terms of the civil war?
Every one of them, for different reasons, they want the Syrian state to be overthrown. In the case of Israel, and even since the start of the conflict in Syria, Israel has had several bombings of Syria and the forces in Syria. It has not been an all-out war, and Syria, wisely, has not responded in kind. But Israel definitely wants to have the Syrian state overthrown, because the Syrian state, for all of its conflicting characteristics, has been one of the few remaining independent Arab states. And not only that, but the Syrian state has been specifically supportive of the Palestinian resistance struggle. In fact, the PFLP, the People's Front for the Liberation of Palestine, until recently had its offices there. They still have people who are, you know, operating there. The Syrian state has been strongly supportive of Hezbollah, which is a national liberation force in Lebanon, which has delivered significant blows to the Israeli state. So Israel wants to get rid of Syria for that reason. Turkey, even though prior to 2009, 2010, had good relationships with, generally good relationships with Syria, has gone all out trying to overthrow the Syrian state. One of the most significant, and not in so much in terms of money, but in terms of logistical support, and the fact that Turkey has a long border with Syria, Turkey's support for the rebels has been significant. The rebel forces have come and gone over the border at will for the last few years. They receive training on the Turkish side of the border. There's an open channel for their supply and resupply of ammunition and weapons and so forth. And basically, you know, Turkey is a country that has given a lot of material support to the forces trying to overthrow the Syrian state. Jordan, and the case for Turkey and Jordan are the same. I mean, the reasons that they're trying to overthrow the Syrian state has less to do with their national interests than doing the bidding for the U.S. For example, Turkey and Jordan, for that matter, had not had any border disputes, had not had any major conflicts with their neighbor in Syria. What it really is that the U.S. Wants the Syrian state overthrown. And in some instances, of course, these states have complementary reasons for wanting to have the Syrian state overthrown. But it's generally, it's the fact that the U.S. has not found it possible or, you know, prudent to engage directly militarily. So it has done it through its proxy forces. And Jordan and Turkey are the, you know, biggest border countries in terms of the amount of assistance that they provide to the opposition in Syria. And while we're talking about outside intervention, why the U.S. media often talk about, you know, Iran and Russia providing support to the Syrian state, In fact, from the very beginning of the civil war, or even at the time when it wasn't even a fully blown civil war, it was Saudi Arabia and also Qatar and United Arab Emirates who have been giving material support to the Syrian, to the rebels.
And in Iraq, at least 10 people were killed and 35 wounded in an attack in that country's center on Monday when a suicide bomber drove an explosives-laden car towards a checkpoint in Az-Zuwaira, south of Baghdad. We have this report from Press TV.
It's been another deadly day in Iraq. A bomb blast in the center of the war-torn country leaves at least 10 people dead. The explosion ripped through the Zuwaira area south of the capital, Baghdad. Another 35 people were wounded. Iraq has been hit by daily bombings and shootings in recent months. On Sunday, violence killed at least 16 people. Based on reports, over 2,700 people have lost their lives this year, nearly 500 of them this month alone. Iraq is bracing for parliamentary elections at the end of April. It is the first parliamentary polls since U.S. forces left the country in 2011.
3 years after the radiological disaster at the Fukushima nuclear plants forced thousands from their homes and led to the deaths of many others, the question remains, is the area safe and free from radiation? The Japanese government in Tokyo says yes and says it is doing everything it can for those who suffered from the disaster. Last year, the World Health Organization indicated that evacuees were exposed to such low levels of radiation that health impacts are likely to be below detectable levels, and chiefly limited to those living closest to the nuclear power plant. However, according to Katsutaka Idugawa, the former mayor of Futaba, an abandoned city in Fukushima Prefecture, the site that his people were supposed to relocate to is still highly radioactive, and it's taking a toll on the health of local children. He spoke with RT's Sophie Shevardnadze.
Your town has moved to a new location, to the neighboring city of Iwaki. Is it safe there, and do you see this as a new start for these people?
I'd like to show you a table with radiation levels around Chernobyl. Radiation levels around Fukushima are four times higher than in Chernobyl. So I think it's too early for people to come back to Fukushima Prefecture. Here you can see radiation levels in our region, Tohoku. This is the epicenter of the earthquake, and the radiation radius is 50 to 100 kilometers, even 200 kilometers, in fact. Fukushima Prefecture is at the very center of this. The city of Iwaki, where Futaba citizens moved, is also located in Fukushima Prefecture. It is by no means safe, no matter what the government says. Exposing people to the current level of radiation in Fukushima is a violation of human rights. It's terrible.
But nevertheless, evacuation advisories are started to be lifted for some cities in the Fukushima area. But you're saying that the government is allowing this despite the danger of radiation?
The Fukushima Prefecture has launched a Come Home campaign. In many cases, evacuees are forced to return. Here's a map of Fukushima Prefecture with areas hit by radiation highlighted in yellow. And you can see that the color covers almost the entire map. Air contamination decreased a little, but soil contamination remains high. And there are still about 2 million people living in the prefecture who have all sorts of medical issues. The authorities claim this has nothing to do with the radiation fallout from Fukushima. But I demanded that the authorities substantiate their claim in writing. Yet they ignored my request. There are some terrible things going on in Fukushima. I remember being touched to the core by the plight of the victims of Chernobyl. I could barely hold back tears whenever I heard any reports about that terrible tragedy. And now, when a similar tragedy happened in Fukushima, there's no one to help us. We must not forget the lessons of Chernobyl. We must protect our children. I talked to local authorities in different places in Fukushima, but no one would listen to me. They believe what the government says. While in reality, radiation is still there, and it is killing our children. They are dying of heart conditions, asthma, leukemia, thyroid complications. Lots of kids are extremely exhausted after school. Others are simply unable to attend PE classes. But the authorities are still hiding the truth from us, and I don't know why. Don't they have children of their own? It hurts so much to know that they can't protect our children.
But I understand many children who have been evacuated are now living in the Fukushima district again. New schools have opened for these children, and you're saying that they're facing radiation there. Is anything being done to help the children affected by the nuclear fallout?
Officially, both the central government and the prefecture authorities say there is no radiation. They're not doing anything, and they're not going to do anything. They say Fukushima Prefecture is safe, and that's why nobody's working to evacuate children, move them elsewhere. We're not even allowed to discuss this.
The National Action Network, the NAACP, and other civil rights organizations are hypocritically asserting a constitutional right to privacy to conceal their corporate funding before the FCC. So says Bruce Dixon, managing editor for BlackAgendaReport.com, in this commentary.
Leading civil rights organizations, the headline on a Politics365.com story said, challenge FCC rule limiting constitutional freedoms. Good thing, you might think. Our traditional civil rights bodies are on the lookout for threats to our constitutional freedoms, at least till you actually read the story. When you do, it turns out that the NAACP, the National Action Network, the National Urban League, the Hispanic Technology and Telecommunications Partnership, the League of United Latin American Citizens, and Rainbow Push all object to a proposed Federal Communications Commission rule that would force them, whenever they weigh in on matters before the FCC, to disclose who they're getting money from. 45 years after the death of Dr. Martin Luther King, all the mainline national civil rights organizations depend heavily upon donations from broadcasters and telecommunications corporations, from Comcast NBC to AT&T and Verizon to Time Warner, ABC Disney, Sprint, T-Mobile, and more. Some of their own top executives in recent years have come from these monopoly industries as well, and the deep pockets of broadcasters and telecoms have sponsored their own shadow organizations of minority entrepreneurs and spokespeople. All of them, from the NAACP, the National Action Network and PUSH, to LULAC, have in recent years backed state and federal legislation that keeps cities and towns from regulating cable networks or laying their own cable. They've all endorsed laws that bar cities and towns from spinning up their own broadband services, which might compete with those of their donors, or which might provide services to poor communities, to schools, libraries, and small businesses in their communities that their donors do not. Every one of these civil rights organizations opposes network neutrality and backs the digital redlining of black, brown, and poor communities. Every one of these so-called civil rights organizations in recent years has backed the privatization or the outright giveaway to their wealthy donors vast amounts of the electromagnetic spectrum, which could and should have been set aside for community broadcasters and the public good. And of course, these corrupt civil rights organizations have unreservedly backed each and every proposed broadcaster and telecom merger, from AT&T's failed attempt to buy T-Mobile to the Comcast NBC deal. And they're lining up right now to back Comcast's current attempt to buy Time Warner Cable as well. Whenever the interests of monopoly broadcasters and telecoms clash with the interests of poor black and brown people, these corrupt civil rights organizations always side with their funders, never with their people. Disclosing their financial ties to telecoms and broadcasters in the very same forum where they shill for their donors will make their pretense to represent the poor and oppressed even more ludicrous.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.